I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny. This week, I'm talking to science writer Mary Roach about the curious science of humans at war in her latest book, Grunt. Before we start the show, I just wanted to let you know that Little Atoms will be taking part in the inaugural London Podcast Festival at King's Place in King's Cross on Saturday the 24th of September. I'll be talking to The Guardian's own Hadley Freeman about her fantastic book, Life Moves Pretty Fast, which is about the lessons she learnt from watching 80s movies. So if you think we don't talk about Dirty Dancing and Ghostbusters enough on Little Atoms, this is the event you've been waiting for. Go to www.kingsplace.co.uk and search for Little Atoms there for tickets. And get in quick, this one's sure to sell out. Mary Roach is the New York Times best-selling author of several popular science books, including Stiff, Spook, Bonk, Packing for Mars and Gulp. And she's written for The Guardian, Wired, BBC Focus, GQ and Vogue. And Mary's latest book, which we're going to talk about today, is Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. Mary, welcome back.
Thank you, Neil.
The Curious Science of Humans at War. So this is going to be a book about bigger and bigger guns and bigger bombs, right?
Wahaha! No such luck. No guns. Well, the chicken gun.
There is one gun.
There's a chicken gun, which we could get to or not. But no big bombs and guns. This is a military science, but the science of keeping people alive more than the science of killing people. That's somebody else's book.
So let's talk about that decision then, because, you know, obviously people would expect the science of war to be about the science of killing people and blowing things up and destruction. And obviously, you know, your country is involved in, seems to be an ongoing war at the moment, a never-ending war, I should say. So why that decision to focus on the life-saving stuff, I guess?
Because it doesn't get covered very much, and you can turn on the Discovery Channel and somebody's going to be blowing something up at any given moment. National Geographic, the History Channel, I mean, we pretty much have the weapons and bombs covered in the media and popular science, well, particularly the visual appeal of large things blowing up. It just also didn't personally appeal to me to spend time with researchers who look into, you know, more effective bullets. I think that could be a really interesting book for someone else to write. I just didn't want to do that. And I think actually to look at, you know, things like extreme heat and exhaustion and food poisoning and flies and sleep deprivation, I think that is in its way kind of a different way to kind of present to people kind of the, it's something that they already know, which war really sucks. It's just a really...
Yeah, I mean, they're more relatable in some respect, perhaps at a less extreme level, but we've all been on holiday. We've all been to places where there are mosquitoes.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think you know, people are familiar with, you know, the drama of combat and life and death and gore and all of that, but even when no one's shooting at you, it's just a really difficult, challenging, kind of god-awful thing to endure. So in its way, the book is kind of a, you know, a sideways anti-war book.
So how did you come to this story? What was it that you first came across that you thought this could make an interesting book?
Oddly, I was reporting a story for Smithsonian Magazine in India, in Nagaland, which is way up in the northeast of India, and it was about the world's hottest chili pepper, arguably the world's hottest chili pepper, the Bhut Jolokia, which I'm probably mispronouncing. But so I'm reporting on that and this crazy eating contest where people eat you know, 11 or 12 of these and are rushed away in an ambulance. And while I'm there, somebody says to me, oh, you know, the Indian Defense Ministry weaponized this pepper and made these non-lethal weapon, kind of a like a tear gas spray, mm-hmm. a powder bomb that kind of you would use to clear a room or disperse a mob, whatever. Anyway, so I thought I need to report on that. I went over to the lab, science labs that the Indian Defense Ministry has, and was just being my usual curious geek self, wandering around. There was someone working on a leech repellent, which I found kind of fascinating, which may, yeah, I guess if your soldiers deal with leeches, you're going to come up with a leech repellent. And that kind of was the seed that made me think, well, this military science could be interesting and broader than you would think, and a little more esoteric and less straightforward than you would think. So that's what got me thinking military science.
I want to start with clothes, as you do in the book, developments in the military uniforms. And there's a few things you look at here. Let's start with the quest to make better flame retardant uniforms.
Yeah.
What happens there?
There's a whole lab at Natick Labs in Massachusetts is where all the uniform stuff is done. It's basically the accessories of being a soldier, the tents, the uniforms, the food. And there's a lab. If you're somebody who comes up with textiles, high-tech textiles, and you've got a new flame-repellent, flame-resistant fabric, you send it off to Natick Labs, and then they start testing it. And the first thing they do is they've got this big, scary laser, which is actually labeled big, scary laser. And they put just a thread in there, and they vaporize it, essentially, and then analyze what gases are coming off, because you don't want a garment that is going to release deadly gas. You know, the garment could be more deadly than the flames. So you want to make sure it's not going to release some toxic gases. So they'll do that, first of all. And then they start to look at how much, you know, heat transfer, how much, you know, they're sort of like a teacup IED, you know, sort of a, you know, this is a scaled down version of the kind of heat that you'd get in a blast. And they're putting the fabric in between. There's a sensor and then the source and looking at how much goes through and what kind of, and what there's sort of a formula for how much, what kind of a burn for a second or third degree you would have with that fabric, so they can test it that way. And then they get to the fun part, which is actually outfitting mannequins. There's a mannequin that kind of walks through fire, and there's another one that just kind of bursts into flame, and they can look at. The day that I was there, they were looking at heat transfer from some of the bling that officers might wear, you know, like a, you know, little medals or buttons or you know, things that aren't just the fabric. That could end up being protective, or it could end up making the burn worse. So that happened to be what they were looking at when I was there. I think it wasn't metal, it was a plastic they were looking at. It's sort of like a name tag or something.
Yeah, not the flame retardantness of like gold braid or something.
Well, they probably have looked at that. They've looked at everything, believe me. Yeah.
And that's a investigation that would have applications outside of the military as well, of course.
Yeah.
And another one of those, which sometimes sounds more interesting to me, is this idea of self-cleaning uniforms as well. So what sort of steps are they taking in that direction?
Yeah, the self-cleaning, the public affairs guy got me interested because he said, oh, yeah, we have self-cleaning underwear. I'm like, I'm there. But as it turns out, it's not. Underwear is not what they were interested in. It was a chem bio suit. It's a suit that would be super repellent of any liquid. You know, in a chemical biological attack, they call it super shedding. Mm-hmm. So it's it mimics a high surface tension situation, you know, like mercury or something, or water, something that beads up and rolls off and leaves almost no residue at all on the fabric. So they're looking at trying to get a fabric that will make almost anything bead up and roll off. And that way the garment itself doesn't need to do as much absorbing of nasty stuff. It's still got probably a layer of activated carbon. But if the outer layer sheds most of it, then you're in better shape. So they were testing that the day that I was there.
And that also means it hasn't got to be as heavy, which is
useful if you're
in a full body suit.
It doesn't have to be as heavy or as hot, which is really important if you're in Afghanistan, say, in summertime. So that's an advantage, particularly with protective gear. If it's really heavy and uncomfortable, soldiers tend to not put it on when they should, and so that's not cool.
And then the other thing, slightly moving on from clothing itself, but you also take a look at the various sort of grooming regimes or rules, and especially I guess that are affecting there being more and more women in the military now. There seems to be a lot of rules about, you know, what you can do with your hair and how you can tie it up, and for instance.
Yeah, I wish I had a copy of them right in front of me, but they're really quite amazing because this is the level of detail. This was the Army grooming policies, which the public affairs guy sent to me. Unbidden, in fact. He's like, you'll enjoy this. And it's so detailed. For example, sideburns, okay, there's the not just how long they can be, but they cannot be flared nor tapered. And each individual hair cannot protrude from the face. I think it was more than a quarter inch or an eighth of an inch. Like, you would get out, your commanding officer could get a ruler out and like cite you for hairs that were too long. And there's oddly no beards, but there's mustaches, as long as the mustache doesn't exceed the width of the mouth. So you can't have one of those sort of droopy handlebar mustaches. No Fu Manchus. It actually says no Fu Manchus. I guess there's not that many soldiers really advocating to be wearing Fu Manchus these days, I imagine. But there were a lot of them for women. There's kind of a built-in sexism there. I think partly because women do more with their hair. So there's a lot more to forbid so that you can't have a diagonal sort of ornamental part. You can't have hair that it's sticking up too high. And it comes out sort of, there was some controversy because it ends up coming down harder on African-American women who do more things to control their hair and to, you know, whether it's cornrows or what have you. So it sort of sounded like they were kind of picking unfairly on African-American women. So anyway, that was sort of a controversy. But the...
there was something about scrunchies.
Scrunchies, yeah. And no, like, butterfly ornaments, no scrunchies. or maybe it was not glitter scrunchies. Anyway, the bottom line was, I believe the bottom line is nothing that really allows you to show your individuality, because the whole idea with a uniform is that you're promoting uniformity. So you have, you know, it's not a group of individuals so much as a mass organism, an army, that is, you know, that you are working together, you're thinking of your unit and not yourself. So I guess that's sort of where all this comes from. But some of it's practical. For example, beards are a problem with gas masks. You can't get a good seal. So there's some things that are practical.
I'm Eric Schlosser, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
It brings us nicely on to heat. You mentioned Afghanistan in the summer, and one of the reasons why soldiers might not choose to wear the protective gear that they're given. What other things what other dangers are there of extreme heat to the military?
Well, heat stroke can be deadly, and it can kind of get out of control quickly. Heat injury and heat illness is sort of a broad label for everything from just fainting to all the way to heat stroke, which if you don't deal with it quickly and get out of the heat and cool down, you die. And there have been, it's in the book, how many? There's, you know, more than you'd really want. It's like, what was it, 475 deaths? Anyway, it's in the book. But and you can imagine, I mean, you've got a lot of equipment you're carrying and you're wearing body armor, which isn't exactly breathable, and you're in this intense heat. So, and you may have diarrhea, which dehydrates you as well. So there's all kinds of things dehydrating you. And heat illness happens when, you know, you only have so much bodily fluid, which, you know, you've got, sweat is made from plasma, the clear portion of blood. So if you're hot and you're working hard, you know, your body wants to send blood and oxygen to your muscles because they're doing the hard work, but at the same time it needs to send blood or plasma to, you know, to your skin to cool you down. So there's this competition, and if the competition gets too extreme, then the body starts to shut down. Like, oh, I guess we don't need digestion, we'll shut that down. Oh, we don't need the brain, we don't, you know, it starts to just deal with the competition in a way that can become a system failure.
You saw there was an experiment going on that you witnessed where there was a guy on a treadmill and his mum who was the scientist. What was going on there?
That was at USIS, which is the Uniformed Services University of Health Sciences. It's near Walter Reed Army Institute of Research, near DC, Silver Spring area. They have a cook box, which is a chamber that you can dial the humidity and the heat up as much as you want, and put someone in on a treadmill or not, uniform or not, however you want to do it. And they were looking at, they're taking blood draws from these folks, and they were they had a rectal temperature, which they really love. We're looking at, is there some sort of simple biomarker that we could, you know, because there's a lot of individual differences in how you deal with heat and how likely you are to succumb to heat injury. And so if they could find a way to identify people easily before sending them off into, you know, the midday sun with a heavy load carrying, you know, and having body armor on, et cetera, if they could identify them, keep them out of that sort of situation or make sure they hydrate extremely well, you know, that would be a plus. That'd be a life-saving technique. So they were, but at that point, the only thing that they knew for sure was that people who are, the fitter you are, the better you deal with heat stroke. But seems to be some genetic difference that they'd love to figure out. So that's what they were working on.
I'm not particularly wanting to dwell too much on the rectal thermometer. There was this real comedy in that they're literally connected to a machine as well. So it's not like a, you know, just a thermometer. It's got a curly wire that goes off to a machine somewhere. So basically,
and the machine that it goes off to is it's about the size of a heavier paperback book, but heavier. Really, almost like a brick. Not quite that heavy, but anyway. So if you're, I don't know if wearing is the right word. If you're plugged into it and you forget, and the device is on the counter, and you walk away, it's embarrassing because either you pull it off onto the floor and break it, or it comes out and you have to go put it back in. And I say this from experience.
Moving on from heat, you also look at noise and how the military deal with noise. A war, it's obvious to say, is incredibly loud, deafening explosions and gunshots and disorientating. And how do they deal with that?
What? No, sorry. This, my husband does that joke every single time. It's so dumb. I just had to do it. Sorry. And I fall for it every time. Yeah, well, military noise is... Yeah, the war is loud. The challenge is not just that it's loud, but that if you protect your ears with earplugs or ear cuffs, now you've lost
situational
awareness, which is a huge deal for a soldier. You want to know who's coming up behind you slowly in a car, or you know, what is that the sound of someone loading a rifle in the around the corner? You also want to be able to communicate with your fellow soldiers and say you're on a foot patrol. And this is something I didn't know, not being a military person. You're walking 15 feet apart because the kill radius of a grenade or that particular fragmentation grenade is about 15 feet. So in order to keep, you don't want people in a small cluster because then all of them could be taken out. So you're walking quite far away from your fellow soldiers. And in order to have a conversation or hear them saying something important, you don't want to have earplugs in. Now, the other thing is that noise tends to happen quickly. You can't predict it. Suddenly there's loud noises and or a firefight breaks out. You're not going to go, oh, just a moment, I'm going to let me get my earplugs, roll them down, and pull back on the outer portion of the ear to properly insert them. Hold on, please. So that's not going to happen. And likewise, some of the transportation is really loud, like the helicopters or the armored personnel carriers. Those are loud. But you're in there for hours. So a couple hours, sure, you'll wear your hearing protection. But I talked to a few special operations guys who had hearing loss, and they were like, yeah, it was hot. They're uncomfortable after a while, the cuffs, and I didn't have it on. And that's when there were explosions, and now I have hearing loss.
And so how serious is the amount of hearing? I mean, all soldiers must suffer some, if they're ever engaged in combat, must suffer some hearing loss. But then how serious is the problem of you know, serious, almost total hearing loss?
Well, hearing disabilities, it's $1 billion a year payout for the VA, Veterans Administration in the U.S. It's the number one expense. It's kind of ubiquitous, and it's one of those invisible injuries where people don't, because they don't see it, you don't have a titanium prosthetic, you don't have a disfiguring burn, you don't really... The civilians don't really think about that, but you know, if you have enough hearing loss that you're unable to communicate with your family, you know, or you're having to get prosthetic hearing devices, I mean, it's life impacting, you know, and really common. So some branches get it more than others. Special operations, artillery, those guys have a lot of hearing loss. Yeah,
one of the theme might be a strong word, but you know, one of the recurring motifs in this book is the idea of, you know, the special force, big macho, wide as he is tall, special forces soldier, being a bit sort of contemptuous of the sort of nerds back at home, coming up with all of these new little sort of inventions to make things slightly better for them. And I presume, again, with something like that, you know, there must be reluctance to put earplugs in because it just seems like a bit pussy or something.
Well, the thing that's available now is something called TCAPs, which is these ear cuffs that have a microphone built in, and they're amazing. I've worn them. I want a pair because now you have bionic hearing. It filters out loud noise. It attenuates loud noises, but it magnifies, say, a human voice. So you put them on, and suddenly you can hear a conversation. You know, that's better than you're like the bionic woman, like dee 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 dee. Like suddenly you're eavesdropping on someone across the street. They're amazing. Special operations guys love them, particularly not for the communications, because there's a mouthpiece and a wireless communication system, so you can communicate with someone in a helicopter overhead or even someone back on base. So they love those. So it's not that they're worried about their hearing. In fact, not just special operations, but artillery and various people I talked about how if you didn't have hearing loss, it meant you hadn't done anything. It was kind of a badge of honor, like you'd be some sort of pussy if you had perfect hearing. If you came out of the military with perfect hearing, you'd be suspect.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
This is Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Mary Roach, and we're talking about her book Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. And Mary, there's a chapter in the book where you look at the dangers posed to vehicles by IEDs, these sort of, you know, bombs planted by the side of the roads, how we can protect the, you know, the bottom of these vehicles from blasts and things. What sort of things are being done there?
Yeah, the work that I was covering for the book was, in fact, for not per roadside, but the more recent version of that, the under the in, actually, the, yeah, because insurgents, They used to put them on the side of the road, and you could up armor the vehicles to kind of deal with that. So they thought, we'll stick them in the roadway. So now there's these tremendous underbody blasts. You can go on YouTube and see just unbelievable, these massive personnel carriers blown into the air, flipping over three times because they put, they bury massive bombs, IEDs, improvised explosive devices. So what they were doing, I was at Aberdeen Proving Ground where they test a lot of weapons, but also the vehicles that are supposed to keep you safe from weapons. They showed me a bunch of things that have been done to make them safer. Really kind of simple stuff like making the chassis V-shaped so it deflects the energy off to the side so you don't have this massive bolus of energy smashing right into the chassis to which the seats are attached. So the energy was going straight into the seat, into the soldiers. So they tended to get these horrible heel injuries where the fat pad would explode and the heel would shatter.
There's a lot of horrible injuries in this book, but that particular one sounds appalling.
It's
a life-changing injury, and it seems like nothing.
Yeah, you'd think, your heel. Oh, big deal, your heel. Boom, you broke your heel. Well, you try walking without that fat pad. It's this fat that's really fibrous and dense. It doesn't exist anywhere else in the body. You can, you can reach down and feel it on your foot, and it's this important piece of the anatomy of the foot because, think about running. You're landing on your heel with several times your body weight. So if you don't have any padding, the heels, the bone is just going to go straight through the skin. So you need this padding. And if it's, if the heel shatters, oh God, you read some of the, they used to call it deck slap in World War II. Yeah, World War I, II, both maybe. You'd have an underwater mine would go off, and if you're standing on the deck of a boat or a sub, it would just smash you in the foot. And they had a lot of heel injuries, and they would talk about, trying to, the bone would be completely fragmented and trying to mold it like it's clay, just sort of smush the pieces back together and try to make it heal. And a lot of time, it's a very high amputation rate. Just after that surgery, it just doesn't work well. There's a lot of pain still in walking. So any way you can mitigate that transfer of energy from the explosion straight to the vehicle, straight to the person. So the V or double V shaped sometimes, but also not having the seats bolted to the bottom of the vehicle, that helps. So now they're bolted to the side or the top, and then sort of on pistons, kind of like on suspension, like automobile suspension, that helps. The thing that I was reporting on when I was there was called WIAMAN, which is the Warrior Injury Assessment Mannequin. It's a crash test dummy specifically for underbody blast because there's no parallel in the automotive world. Car crashes are either head-on or side impact or rear-enders, and in no case does the impact really approximate anything like a bomb going off underneath you. So they're... they have been doing that, the work that was done, back in the 60s with cars to come up with a crash test dummy. They're doing that now at Aberdeen, and that, to make a crash test dummy that is high fidelity, that really tells you what would happen to a human being in this case, you need to work with cadavers. So, of course, calling Mary Roach.
Cadaver woman.
So they were doing cadaver tests. They weren't blowing up a vehicle because those are expensive, but they had a seat set up on a platform and then some C4 explosive underneath, under the platform, which they would then set off, and then they would go and do an autopsy on the cadaver. It's not blowing it into bits. It really, when you watch it in real time, it just looks like they took a speed bump too fast, but when you slow it down, you see this tremendous flailing of limbs, and it's happening too fast for the body to accommodate it. Bodies can stretch and give a lot, but they need time to do it. Mm-hmm. So if you watch this, slowed down, it almost looks like modern dance, because the body's fine as long as you move slowly and fluidly, but if it's just boom in a split second, it can't keep up and it breaks. So fractures and things, not necessarily breaking apart. I mean, in the extreme, yes, breaking apart. So they go and they do an autopsy, look at this amount of explosive in this distance, whatever, you'd have this kind of injury. So then all that information informs the dummy. So now if some contractor says, here's this armored personnel carrier that everyone will be completely safe, they can say, oh yeah, let's put our dummy in here and let's see what happens. Similar to what the automotive industry has had for some time. So that's what they were working on there, the bunch of bioengineers.
Well, people obviously do get injured, and one of the, the ironies of modern combat, modern medicine, is that, you know, we've been able to, as time gone on, save people from greater and greater injuries, injuries that would have been fatal a few years ago, which means that there are many more multiple amputees back in the world. And you know, one of the things that happen, as well as losing limbs, soldiers get genital injuries as well, mm-hmm. which you talk about in the book. You talk about, I suppose, the sort of after effects of that, but also transplants, which we'll get onto in a moment. But clearly, you know, it's one thing coming back and trying to cope with life out of the military, having lost a leg or both legs or two legs and an arm. But there are, you know, there are special considerations when one has lost your genitals.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and it's like you said, it's an injury that's much more common now because the medical care is faster to arrive and more effective. And also the explosions, they're larger, the bombs are bigger. So you've got these tremendous injuries and people surviving, which is something they wouldn't have survived before. So the number of genital injuries has been climbing, and so they've had to really look at, you know, what are like reconstructive techniques. Interestingly, some of the reconstructive surgery, there's been collaboration between the transgender world and the military, because those are the surgeons who know how to rebuild a penis or to build one from scratch, because you are building from scratch. You're taking, you know, there are several techniques, but the one that I had explained to me, you're taking skin from the underside of the arm, because that's hairless, for one thing. You know, you don't want a hairy penis, probably. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm just assuming.
There was an issue with the urethra as well.
Yeah, that's right. If you can rebuild a urethra, you can do that from any hairless tissue. But one of the things that they've been using, I observed a urethra repair. This man had damage to the urethra, but the rest, you know, it was mostly the urethra had been, you know, severed from, it was a shrapnel. And they take tissue from the inside of the mouth, and not only is that hairless, but it's used to moisture. Mm-hmm. So it's not going to degrade when it's exposed to moisture, urine. So I thought it was pretty cool. And I had no idea. I came into the operating room and I expected to see, you know, they put the cloths over everything, but the part they're working on, and they're up at his head, and I'm like, am I in the wrong operating room? Is this not a penis surgery? But in fact, they first were harvesting a rectangle of tissue from his cheek to then roll up and build a urethra with. So anyway, yeah, there are lots of things you can do. You're building it from scratch. The one ingredient that isn't available is the erectile tissue. And so for that, they're using implants, which has been around for erectile dysfunction for quite a while.
It must be like a pump.
Yeah, it's a saline pump. Well, there's different models, but I think last time I heard about it, there's a little bladder of saline that they, I guess, put in the scrotum, and a little squeezable pump. So then you can pump it in and then let it out. So that's how you do your erection. There is a little bit of there's erectile tissue in the nose. But nobody's. I asked around, like, "Hey, can't you take that erectile tissue?" Because when you have a cold, it's kind of an erection of the nose. Mm-hmm. You're not with blood, and as in an erection, but it's erectile tissue. And they kind of looked at me like, "Yeah, there's not a whole lot in there." And nobody's tried that. But I don't know. I'm hoping that one day someone will read Grunt and go, "By God, that's an excellent idea. Let's try that."
That'd be someone with a huge nose.
Get somebody with a huge nose.
I'm Caitlin Doty. You're listening to Resonance FM, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
There's a feeling that comes out of this being, you know, you're lucky to survive. You know, you've been blown up. You're lucky to survive. That's really all you should wish for. This idea coming back from like the sort of top brass, and they weren't necessarily sympathetic to the idea.
Yeah.
That, I mean, you described it as, but they described like being able to get an erection after that injury is like the icing on the cake.
Yeah.
Which clearly isn't. You know, what sort of aftercare is, I suppose, not being done, really, but you do talk to some people who are trying to sort of do that, to soldiers who come back with that sort of
That's
injury
right,
and
yeah.
want to basically take up their lives again with their wives.
Yeah, yeah. There has been there's a woman named Christine Delaurier who was a nurse at Walter Reed, and this has sort of been a personal cause of hers. She told me that there isn't a staff position, full-time staff position, just as a sex therapist or intimacy counselor, however you want to say it. And I said to her, is that a budget issue? There's just not enough money and it's not a priority. And she said, it's that, but it's also a discomfort on the part of the military organization with focusing on sexuality. Yeah, that it's a lifestyle issue. And there are people at Walter Reed, andrologist, a surgeon who you know, he there's the urology guy for the penis, the andrology guy is the testicles and the reproductive equipment, and he's very passionate about this too. And he said, you know, people will say like, oh, it's important that they walk, that's important, and he's going, no, they can sit in a wheelchair, they don't have to walk, and they're like, oh, how could you say that, it's important that they walk. And he said, it's important that they have sex too, you know, there's a real sense that, oh, that's as you said, icing on the cake. And I asked her, I said, what's the divorce rate like in this population? And she said, divorce rate, try suicide rate. You know, it's a big deal. And, she's hoping just by blabbing about this on different podcasts on the radio that someone will kind of address that and that they'll hire her or anybody. You know, just to make it sort of a part of aftercare, just very matter of fact, there is this book I forget the exact title. It's in Grunt, but it's essentially sexual advice for somebody, not just it's for amputees and veterans, not just a genital injury, but let's say you're missing two legs and a hand. Well, what kind of positions work? What kind of hardware can you buy? What sort of, there are resources that people aren't naturally aware of. And so there's this book. It's like, here's some really helpful stuff. And it's just making it straightforward and not making it kind of a hush-hush embarrassing or tee-hee thing. It's like, here, this might be helpful. Here's this book. It's a booklet, you know. So that's been great that there's this resource. But, you know, that's been sort of done on the side just by people who care a lot about it. It hasn't really been something that the Pentagon has embraced the way they might.
There are lots of injuries, obviously, that happen to soldiers out in the field serving military people, and there are medics that are out there with them to sort of deal with some of those injuries if possible. But of course, this is a war. There's, you know, bombs going off all around and snipers shooting at them. And performing an operation in an operating theatre is a stressful enough job. Mm-hmm. How do you, you know, stuff somebody's guts back in or tie up a tourniquet and somebody's, you know, pumping femoral artery when there's people shooting at you?
Exactly. That's it's a difficult thing to show someone how to do. There's a concept called stress inoculation, which is if you have your medics, your medic trainees, if you have them try these different techniques in a simulated combat environment, make it as stressful as you can without actually shooting live weapons at them, then hopefully they'll be a little better equipped to deal with the real deal. So there's a place in outside Camp Pendleton near San Diego, Southern California, there's a Marine Corps base. And it's a former movie studio. There was this guy, Stu Siegel, he used to do action films and combat films. And so he's set up for pyrotechnics, loud noises, explosions. He's very good at that. And then they bring in actors, in some cases amputee actors, and they outfit them with very realistic gore. Like they put a sleeve over the stump and they've got it attached to like a camelback, a backpack with, you know, I think it was 3 liters of stage blood and a pump, and it's pumping realistically. And so and there's a remote control for the bleed, so that if the person who's doing the tourniquet doesn't do it quickly enough, the actor bleeds out and dies, and then the instructor yells at you. And so it's all designed to be really stressful. Meanwhile, there's loud explosions going off, not real ones, but sound effects and dust hits to make it look like someone actually is shooting a rifle close by. So there's this whole package of stress. And it's not just stressful in and of itself. It's just also the fight or flight response when you're frightened. you know, your body responds by sending blood to your muscles so you can run away quickly, and your frontal lobe doesn't get, your brain doesn't get the decision making parts of the brain, that the kind of cognitive decision making and fine tuning stuff doesn't get the same amount of blood that it normally does, and so you're essentially, as somebody described it to me, fast, strong, and dumb. And that's great if you need to run away or climb a tree or hurl a rock, but if you need to do, cut an emergency airway or do a needle decompression and get it in the right spot, somebody has a collapsed lung, you don't want to be cognitively impaired. So that's another reason to try to get medics accustomed to, however they can, coping, focusing, not getting tunnel vision. That's another thing that happens. You get tunnel vision and you sort of lose the larger picture. So, it's amazing that these people are able to do what they're doing in the scenario that they're doing it. And that's how you train. But there's other ways to train too. There's people train on anesthetized livestock. They go to emergency rooms in inner city where there's lots of gunshots and knifings and things. And so there are various ways that the military tries to kind of expose people to a little bit of what they're going to be dealing with.
Listening to Little Atoms, I'm Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Mary Roach about Mary's latest book, Grunts, The Curious Science of Humans at War. And Mary, you brought up the difficult subject of diarrhea early on in the interview. How much of a problem is it?
It's changed over time. It used to be a huge issue. Dysentery and diarrhea killed way more soldiers than bullets and bombs. The Mexican-American War, I think it was 7-1. Deaths from disease and mostly dysentery, but also malaria, versus one combat death, 7-1. In Vietnam, 4-1, hospital admissions for disease versus combat injuries. So it used to be a huge deal, partly because of you had a situation where you've got a camp out in a field in the summer, open pit latrine, flies landing in the crap, flying over to the mess area, which isn't screened, landing in the food, depositing pathogens from their feet, inoculating the food, which sits in the sun for hours, and then, it multiplies, the pathogens multiply exponentially. Now you've got hundreds of sick, dehydrating soldiers. So diarrhea used to be huge. I mean, diarrhea would lose you your battles. I mean, it was a huge factor. Now, of course, it was Walter Reed who figured out the whole idea that the mechanical vector of the flies would land and then just fly over and deposit the bacteria or virus, whatever, onto the food. He figured that out. And once that connection was made, hygiene became a big issue. You had fly control units, you had sanitation officers. There was actually, in one of the World War II battles in North Africa, there was a fly death quota. Every soldier had to kill 50 flies a day. There were these posters like, "This is the enemy," and a picture of a big fly with a bayonet in its gut. So nowadays, diarrhea is mostly an issue in special operations, small teams going out into the countryside, talking with villagers, village elders, trying to get information, whatever their assignment is. They're far from base, and they're eating, say, goat that hasn't been refrigerated or water that hasn't been treated, and they get food poisoning and pretty severe diarrhea, really often, twice as often as the folks who are back on base.
So you said earlier on that you'd written to the military requesting to speak to some special forces soldiers that might have experienced trouble with diarrhea. So how did that go?
That was, I think, perhaps the biggest and strangest reporting challenge of my career, because I was at Camp Lemonnier in North Africa, where there's a lot of counterinsurgency work. And these guys, these special operations guys, they have their own. They're in a restricted zone. No one can go in unless they have full clearance. So I couldn't, the only time I could find them to talk to them was mealtime, which is, as you can imagine, an awkward time to sit down with someone and bring up diarrhea, particularly some kind of imposing kind of macho. I mean, they are these, at least at Camp Lemonnier anyway, these guys stand out. They're the only ones with, they're allowed to have beards so they can fit in with the Muslim population where all the men have beards. So they stand out. They're very, they have this kind of just this air to them, and they're not easy guys to just say, hey, sit down with and chit chat. You know, they keep to themselves. They really only come out to eat, and as one guy in the public affairs office pointed out, and to steal our women. So I had, and they eat quickly. They come in, they sit down, they eat, and they leave. They don't hang out, they don't chit chat, they don't socialize with the rest of the base. So I had to kind of move in. It was like a mission. Okay, go. So I went across with this public affairs guy, and I forced him to introduce us. And it was, you know, it was sort of an awkward, he saw us coming and he said, I'm done, I'm leaving, and started to pick up his tray. And I said, actually, I'm an author here. I'm working on a chapter about diarrhea. And I know, you know, it sounds like a silly topic. And he goes, it's not. Sit down. You're welcome to sit down. So we had this really interesting conversation. He couldn't really give me the there I was and describe the mission because it's classified, but he was very candid about what that's like. And he's like, yeah, I've soiled my pants in Iraq. I've soiled my pants in Afghanistan. It happens. It happens all the time. And you just keep going, so to speak. You keep going with the mission. You know, it's sort of a, you know, I said, you do? You just keep, he goes, yeah, it's kind of a life or death situation. If you're in a hide, you know, if you're in sort of, you know, in sort of a dugout area with, they tend to use a lot of Ziploc bags, and they'll put kitty litter in Ziploc bags. And they go through a lot of kitty litter. There was a point where some higher up in the Special Operations Command was like, why are we requisitioning kitty litter? It's like, obviously you haven't been out there. Because it's highly absorbent.
There's a great example in here of a hunt for a technology that would aid the military that is just like turned out to be nonsensical. I'm talking about tell us the story of the quest for a successful shark repellent. First of all, why was that necessary?
Yeah, this was World War II, and this was the first time American troops were flying or sailing over or on temperate tropical waters. You know, it was in World War One. It was, you know, farther north. There weren't a lot of sharks. So because it's shark territory, the flyers were, there was all this hysteria about sharks. And they were having trouble keeping flyers. It's funny, you're willing to risk being shot down and dying, but God forbid you should be attacked by a shark. I don't know what I'm going to be. No sharks for me. It was a weird hysteria, but it seemed to have gripped the troops to the extent that the Navy contracted some folks in the OSS, forerunner to the CIA, said, come up, find us something, some compound we can throw into the water that will repel sharks. And there was sort of an acknowledgement that even if it doesn't work that well, it will make them feel better. It's a pink pill, as they put it. It's a psychological reassuring object to have in your life raft or in your, you know, your life vest or whatever it is. You know, they wanted a small cake, you know, little, just something that would dissolve in the water. And dozens of compounds were tried. They were tried on captive sharks in tanks. They were taken out to the waters off Ecuador, and they were tried and found ultimately really not to do much good. There's one Captain Baldridge, I think it was. This guy, I talked to him. He's in his 90s now. He's like, yeah. He did this study where if you looked at the time it takes, you know, for a shark to kind of close in and attack you, and the time it takes for a cake of this repellent to dilute to the point where it's completely ineffective. It's doing nothing for you. And then, as it turned out, the other fact that makes this all kind of absurd is that no one at that point, there was no recorded cases in the Navy of anybody being attacked by sharks. It wasn't happening. Sharks are pretty shy. They're not, I think it's like 2,500, this is the International Shark Attack File, which has been going since this project. 2,500 downed flyers and I think 12 instances of injury or death. So it's not common, and it's very difficult to repel a shark, but it's also not particularly necessary.
Then that's interesting, isn't it? Because, like, you know, as well as, like, you know, Jaws making everybody scared to go into the sea... Like, we all immediately think of Robert Shaw telling that story about, you know, the sharks eating all of the sailors as well. You know, is it just a myth?
The USS Indianapolis, yeah. You're talking about. You know, though, there were a good number of mutilated bodies, but if you look at the accounts of survivors,
they'll go for the dead bodies.
Yeah, that's right. And the Navy sponsored a lot of research after the shark repellent fiasco. They sponsored a lot of research into, you know, what attracts them. Does blood attract them? Does thrashing attract them or repel them? You know, what's attracting them and what's repelling them? So they did a tremendous amount of work in that area and basically found that they're very shy. They'd much rather, what attracts them is the scent of a stressed out fish. They want their prey, and they want their prey to be injured in an easy target.
Mm-hmm.
So distressed grouper water was, in fact, in one of my favorite experiment. They compared, they had a shark in an enclosure, and they had distressed grouper water, and they had quiescent grouper water. And the sharks went, you know, made a beeline for the distressed grouper water because it's the blood and guts and panic from a fish. That's what they want because it's an easy meal. They're not interested in, they put a bleeding rat in the tank, not interested. Mammal blood, not an attractant. It's not their normal prey. And in fact, at one point, the rat accidentally kicked, you know, in its efforts to escape, kicked the shark in the nose. The shark turns around and runs away. Bear in mind, these are not great whites. These are, you know, lemon sharks, dusky sharks, black tip sharks. They're smaller, but which is, you know, most of the cases of, yeah, you talk to someone who's like, there's a guy who's a videographer I interviewed. He's like, well, that depends on, you know, what shark are we talking about? Mm-hmm. You can, you know, one time we threw bagels over the side of the ship, and like one kind of shark was scared away, another kind of shark was attracted. So, you know, should you bring bagels with you? I don't know, it depends on the kind of shark.
You mentioned, if I can awkwardly segue from the idea of distressed fish water to an incidental story that comes up in that section about bears.
Really? Yeah, okay, well, as we were saying, okay, so if your prey is normally fish, you are attracted to the scent of fish. Now, there was a case in the National Park Service in the United States where there was a bear attack, and there was speculation that the women were menstruating and that the blood had drawn the bears. And so the National Park Service, or some researchers, wildlife biologists who worked for the Park Service, devised this experiment. There are actually two studies of blood, human blood, and menstrual blood, and bears, and different findings. Okay, polar bears, yes. Grizzly bears and black bears, no. Okay, polar bears, they're eating fishy things. Fishy trimethylamine, fishy scent is also vaginal scent, to get a little graphic here. If you could entice a polar bear with a used tampon, but not a black bear or a grizzly bear. They're not interested. And the studies have been done, and they're quite entertaining. They're detailed in the book. But anyway, the bottom line is, if you smell like their prey, then you want to stay clear.
I'm Tom Barbash, and you're listening to Little Adams, a radio show about ideas and culture.
I want to talk about submarines for a bit. You mentioned that you managed to get out onto a submarine somewhere in the North Atlantic. How would you have gone off that submarine if anything had gone wrong?
Depends on a number of factors. If we were somewhere in the neighborhood of 600 feet down, you can go. There's an escape trunk on board, and you could actually just put on your escape suit and go out just as you in the escape suit, make your way to the surface. The suit becomes a flotation device, a little sort of mini raft. So in that case, it's, you know, extremely stressful, but it can be done up to 600. Ideally, less than 600 feet, but I think 600 feet's the depth, the maximum depth at which that has been done. If you're going down to about 2,000 feet, there's the chance to get out via a submersible rescue vehicle. And there are those stationed all around the globe, hopefully no farther away than, say, like 7 days away, hopefully a lot less. And any deeper than that, if you go down deeper than that, you're kind of SOL. Yeah.
You went to the delightfully named USS Buttercup, which is like a sort of training facility for submariners, and they have like a sort of way to simulate that escape.
Yes. Yeah. I was at, actually there are two, there's the USS Buttercup, which is an even more stressful experience than the one I saw at the submarine school. The escape train, there's an escape trainer there, and it's an engine room, you know, like a model of an engine room. And then there are the, it's set up where there's a guy at the control panel who can initiate all of these very alarming leaks, and the students have to stop the leaks. And there are various ways to do that. Surprisingly simple and low tech, like a pine plug. Okay, this is sort of like a conical. This is sort of like something you'd see in a geometry classroom. It's just you put the point in the hole and you hammer it in, and pine absorbs water and expands a bit, so it's a pretty tight seal. So there's some of them where you can use that. Or winding a piece of twine, it's somewhere between string and rope, and you would wind that around the leak, so you're kind of coming up on it from the side and strangling it, you know, cutting it off. You can't just put it flat over it. It will push it back, but you can sneak up on the leak. So they have a number of devices where you do that. And it's cold water, and sometimes the lights will go out, and you have to do it in the dark. And so the students are just trained in ways to stop a leak and do it fast.
And obviously, if you're in a submarine and you're any distance underwater, a leak is, it's not like a leaking bathtub.
No. Yeah, depending, how big the hole is and how the deeper you are, the more water is going to come in. Just like the pressure is just pushing in tremendous amounts of water very quickly. I mean, one of the guys who was running the simulation, the class, was talking about the USS Cole and that, you know, that big hole that was blown in the side. I mean, and he said they were just stuffing anything into it, like mattresses, you know, just like plug the hole quickly. Whatever you have at hand, get it plugged. So,
and you actually do talk about a couple of actual submarine accidents,
yeah,
that happened. They have the bizarrely named USS Tang, which says it's always named after a soft drink, yeah, and the Squalus. What happened there?
Well, the Tang torpedoed itself, oddly enough. Torpedoes are not, they sometimes behave erratically. The torpedo kind of turned, and at the same time, I guess, that the sub was turning. Anyway, it came around and hit the tail of the sub. And the Tang was this was the first time that there was a, submariners were using the escape trunk and the technology. They had sort of a Mommsen lung, it's called. It's just, it's a, you know, kind of a hood and a way for you to breathe a little bit as you escape. But you first, you have to be in this trunk and equalize the pressure so you can open the hatch. And that's tricky stuff, because you're starting to float. You've got to equalize, your ears are all messed up, and you're dealing with a lot of things at once, plus operating the trunk. And none of them had been trained, and very, very few of them got out. Even though the technology was there and they were at a depth at which they could escape, they couldn't do it. They didn't know what to do. And they tried once and they gave up. And a lot of them died unnecessarily for that reason. Well, partly for that reason, but there's now this 30-foot column of water at the sub school. It's called the Pressurized Submarine Escape Trainer, and there's an escape trunk, and you put on your suit and you do it. You go through the motions and you shoot up to the top, and those guys were pretty nervous. I mean, I don't blame them. I mean, it's an awkward thing. I mean, it's 30 feet of water. It's pretty, it's not extreme pressure, but it's uncomfortable. You got to be able to clear your ears, you've got water, you're dealing with the suit and the air coming into the suit, and then, the hatch opens and you shoot out and you've got to remember, if you have the suit, you can breathe, but they have them do it without the suit. And in that case, you have to shout as you go up to make sure you're exhaling. Otherwise, if you hold your breath, you rupture parts of the lung. So they got to remember to shout as they go up. It's a little bit risky. They wouldn't let me do it. I wanted to do it. I was secretly relieved when I said no.
Just to finish off there, one more question. So almost inevitably, you end up at the end of this book at an autopsy. Everybody that's killed in military action ends up with an autopsy. How are they trying to, use those bodies to gain knowledge to stop other people dying?
Yeah, there's a program called Feedback to the Field. And what happens is They take cases, not every single one, but ones that might be helpful or illustrative. And they have what's called a combat mortality conference. And I was at that. I wasn't actually at an autopsy. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't permit someone to be at an autopsy. But the mortality conference, that is a teleconference between the medical examiner who did the autopsy. And the autopsy includes all of the life-saving equipment that is left in place, whether it's a tourniquet or needle decompression for a collapsed lung, whatever it is, that's left in place. So the medical examiner can see if it was placed properly, if the equipment's working the way the manufacturer said it would. And basically just, did anything go wrong here that could have, had it not gone wrong, saved the life? And that information is given to the medical provider in the field, the people that actually worked on this soldier or Marine. And so they get this direct feedback, which is great. It's not waiting for someone to publish a paper where 2 years down the line this information will make its way to the community of medical providers. And by that time, they're using different equipment, or the situation has changed, or we're in a different war. So it gives them immediate feedback, which has been great. So it's interesting to sit in on that meeting. Very sobering.
That's where we'll have to leave it. So I've been talking to Mary Roach. We've been talking about her book, Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War, which is out now from One World. Mary, it's been wonderful having you back. Thanks for telling me about it.
Oh, you bet. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
You can find the Little Atoms podcast on iTunes, and you can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms.
If you'd like to donate a little money to support the show, you can do so at littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.